Welcome everyone to the Voice of Discord's podcast. I'm your host, Robin Achimwe. I am a first year student at Georgetown University. I'm also glad to have two co-hosts on this podcast who will serve as two voices bringing diverse perspectives on the platform. If each of them could introduce themselves.
Oh. Hi, I'm Monique. I'm 18 from New York City, and I'm a student in the college at Georgetown. I'm planning to major in government and minor in African-American studies. And the reason that I want to do this podcast is because it's really important to me that there's a decrease in polarization in this country and just on this campus. So I think me being the Democrat on the podcast will be really helpful.
My name's Connor Brennan. I'm a student here at Georgetown School of Foreign Service, studying international political economy. I'm here today mostly as a more independent sort of centrist voice here. And I'm here just because I think that overall in the political environment that we have today, there's just so much pressure to go either way on the spectrum. And there's not really much, you know, free thinking allowed with how we have things set up. So I'm here to try to bring up some ideas outside the regular spectrum of what we may see.
So The Voice of Discourse is a political podcast recorded at Georgetown University by students who have a passion of discussing and engaging in current political affairs. We strive to present diverse perspectives on the different issues that we discuss, and we reach to make a case for why we hold such beliefs. This podcast gives a voice to politically inclined students outside of mainstream media where we are not very much so represented. The podcast will explore the different dynamics that come with students who may have diverse political views and how we can still hold true to our own convictions while being in a space where they are challenged or praised. We highly value the voice that students have in meaningful dialogue to bring about understanding and impact within the current political debate that we are being faced with in our nation. So on to the first topic of this episode. What were your initial reactions to the election of the new Congress? And we can start with Monique on that.
So obviously for me, it was very positive. It was the largest amount of like diverse people we ever had in Congress, like women, racial wise, sexual orientation. And the amount of red seats that were flipped was a very good sign for 2020. I do hope that there's a willingness for the new Congress to work with the people that are still there. I've heard a lot of critique from like a lot of people just saying that, like, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that she thinks she knows everything and all this stuff. And I mean, I don't know her, so I don't know what's going through her mind, but I hope that she does realize that to a certain extent, you're gonna have to work with people that have been in Congress for years. And so you can't just go around bashing everyone. Like you have to be very, political at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And Connor?
Well, I'd like to first say that, yes, it's extremely positive that we're seeing a body that is more representative of the American populace. Mm-hmm. However, my big worry here is that we're making the elections, and by the way, the key word in this question is our reaction to the election of mm-hmm. them. I think that we're making it far too much about identity than it should be. Now, I definitely say that there is something to be said about identity, but there is some more to be said about the policies that are incumbent upon someone that is a candidate. And one thing that kind of really worried me about this election was the fact that we don't seem not to be focusing on policies anymore rather than just the labels and what we can try to tie people to. A great example of this would be back home in my home state of Massachusetts, our Governor Charlie Baker. Now, Charlie, who's by the way one of my favorite politicians, but he's about as vehemently anti-Trump as you can get, especially on the Republican side. Yet constantly his opponent, Jay Gonzalez, tried to go and tie him back to Trump. And it's just, quite frankly, just not the case wasn't ever there. But the fact is, it becomes less about the actual policies each are producing. And this is just one example, but this happens across the country. The elections come less about the actual policies, more about where your party line is or what your skin color may be or so forth. And I just don't think that's the right way we ought to go in as a country. That leads us more towards tribalism than actually coming together as a country. I think there's something very worrying about that.
Now, so we'll get to the policy aspect of this new Congress and whatnot, but I do think that identity does play a big part into the kind of policies that we do see being represented and being passed within Congress and whatnot. And on that topic, I will ask you a little bit more about identity because I do think that it's important that people are being represented within Congress. So we had more than 100 women currently serve in the House of of Representatives. Mm-hmm. About 115 of this new Congress identify as people of color. The first two Native American women were elected. There's an increase in LGBTQ representation. And so on this aspect, in terms of like this demographic shift, what do you think that says about our country, where we're headed in terms of racial, gender, and other forms of representation? I know you said that we shouldn't focus too much on identity, but it is important that people look to their leaders and see that they're being represented. What do you think this surge in demographic shift, what do you think that says about where our country's headed?
So I think what it's showing is that there is a greater acceptance of these people in the political, of different minority groups in the political sphere, as it should be. Mm. But my worry is, though, that it should be more just kind of passive acceptance of, yeah, it's just another person, not, you know, oh, this is an African-American person or a LGBTQ person. It should just be that they're a person. Mm. It's when those labels fall down that we can actually achieve equality and move forward. Now, I think that there is something about the labels, but it's supposed to be more as a reflection of progress rather than the actual progress itself.
And Monique, what do you say about that? Being a person of color and being on the Democratic side, what do you think about identity, you know, within politics and representation?
Well, I agree that, you know, you shouldn't vote for someone because of the color of their skin or because they have the same sexual orientation as you. But I do think that there is a certain aspect that identity plays in a person's life, especially like a person of color. Like, you just can't, certain things you can't, it's hard to separate them. And so, yes, like, you shouldn't just vote for them because they're black or whatever, but you can't expect it to just be, oh, we're all Americans. Like, no, there's certain historical things that have happened where it's like, oh, wow, this is the first black president. Why is it first black president? Because for so long, everyone thought that was unachievable. Oh, the first two Native American people elected to Congress, for so long, that was thought unachievable. So because this is happening, because these are the first of the first, it's very important that we acknowledge it. But at the end of the day, I do agree with you that, you know, you shouldn't vote with the labels, I guess. Like, you shouldn't just vote with them because, like, you should look at their policy, but also don't exclude their identity from who they, like, from who they are.
And, oh, if I may add to that.
Yeah.
You have an absolutely extremely good point there. Well, yes, the labels do matter, but I say it's more as a just kind of as something to judge judge progress rather than actually the thing to go and work towards progress for. And what I'm trying to make with the point here is, like you said, you know, we shouldn't be voting for people based on labels. However, it does happen. And it happens a surprising amount. And whether it's necessarily, and well, it happens a surprising amount, both on, say, support this person because they might be insert X trait, or also don't support these people because they are insert Y trait. For example, all the GOP people are, you know, all white males, so forth, some you commonly hear around. And that is, in my mind, just as toxic and just as, quite frankly, threatening to democracy and just overall our spirit as a nation as what we've talked about on the other side. And this even happens at the student level, too. I remember, I serve in Georgetown as one of the student senators. And I remember during the election, I was talking to one of my friends. And, you know, talking to her about my policies and all that, she's like, Connor, I think you have a great thing, but I'm not going to vote for you. I'm like, well, wait, why? And she's like, well, I'm going to vote for all female candidates because I think there should be a female in there. And that's great, you know, but as we talked more about it, she said, yeah, you know, some of the guys, I really think they might have the better platforms or everything, but I'm going to vote for females because that's what I want to see up there. So it happens. It is happening more and more. And it just seems more to me like then people's entire perceptions become faced more upon traits that we can't decide. And that's not right to me. There's something very fundamentally wrong with that in my mind.
Now, I would like to say this, you know, I think for a long time we know that within our country, that race and identity has been used as sort of a key markers to whether people could get in certain positions, whether they could get within politics. And my thing is, it so bad that sometimes people use that those same categorizations as a way to say, well, we need more people from these groups to get in there. And we all know that our country is getting more diverse, that, you know, in a few years, our country will be majority minority and whatnot. Shouldn't both parties reflect how our country is going to look like and how our country looks like. And I know we talk about, you know, the Republican Party is looking more white and male, you know. Do you not see that as an issue and as a problem and as a way of saying that maybe this party is not fully representing, you know, the makeup and the look of this country? Do you not see that as an issue?
Oh, I do think it is an issue. But granted, that's more of an issue for how the success of Republicans may go in the future. And I think there does have to be a reckoning for them. The way I see it, I see the kind of turning point in the Republican Party at 2012, actually. When Mitt Romney, who is a lot more of a centrist Republican than we see these days, when he ended up getting turned down, what ended up happening, and also there's some things to be said about the debates and all that, and how that's kind of when Republicans very seriously, like to a new level, began to feel targeted by the media. Just a great example of that in the debate with the fact check on the Benghazi conflict that ended up actually being wrong. But that's a story for another day. But my thing here is that you have this case after 2012 where Republicans genuinely feel more and more as if they're victims. And
victims of what exactly?
Victims of either bias or just feeling as if people are judging them based on traits that they were born with. Kind of the idea of like, oh, you know, like, for example, like because I might be white and male, thereby I might be targeted more by ethnicity and politics, which is a very like backwards, perhaps way of
Negative way or
in a negative way. Often people feel as if like, you know, Republicans are often given a bad case in the media, which there is something to be said about that. But my entire point here is that, you know, after the 2012 election, you saw the Republicans go farther right than really anyone ever thought. And the Republican actually voters, the establishment has since gone with where the voters were going. But you could really see in the 2016 election, and this is my big point here, in the 2016 election, there was a big divide between the Republican establishment and Republican voters. A lot of the establishment was behind Marco Rubio. And if we're looking at, you know, the racial aspects of the Republican Party, Marco Rubio is a son of a Cuban immigrant. And he brought together a lot of, you know, the identity that quite frankly the Republican Party should have embraced. And the Republican establishment could see that and were of a similar mindset. Yet look who ends up making it out of the primary. It's not Marco. It's Donald Trump, who is about as far from that vision as you could possibly get on that stage. So I think what we're kind of seeing here is that Republicans in this system, where there does seem to be a bit of media bias, and there does seem to be a growing resentment against their side of where they often are in the identity spectrum there, that their response to that ends up being more reactionary. And eventually that will put them in a deficit of members in the House of Representatives and Senate, slowly but surely, you know, with the regular fluxes that happen in electoral politics. But it'll eventually be that they'll have to adapt their identity or get driven out. And whether that means another party to replace them or not, that's up in the air. But it's kind of that they have to change or be run over at this point.
All right.
Yeah.
And so, and then, you know, on the Democratic side, obviously, you know, that party reflects more of the representation that we see within this country. You know, what would this mean for the Democratic Party in terms of whether they will have to move to refine and repurpose their agenda to closely align with the needs of their increasingly diverse base, or will they stick to trying to appease, you know, what I would say, moderate whites for the promise of electoral victory in general elections, which, again, one could also make the argument that that's a present appeasement for short-term benefit, but not long-term sustainability. So what's the demographic shift? What kind of effect is that going to have on Democratic agenda and policies?
I mean, I definitely think that there's going to need to be a sort of redefining of the Democratic Party. Like we've seen with, there's this new wave of kind of like socialist Democrats, which is far different than like the establishment Democrats. And, but then there's, both of these people are still in power. And if we want to stop, if we want to prevent what happened with like the Tea Party and all that stuff happening in the Democratic Party, we're definitely going to have to, all of Congress is going to have to come together and try to decide what is the goal, like have a central idea. And I think that's what I've heard from a lot of people recently. It's just that it's like, what is the Democratic Party? People don't know because there's like this divide in it. But I think going off on another kind of track, I think that this the shift also showed that a lot of young people are voting, mm-hmm. which I like. I always, my textbooks in high school, they always told me that young people are like the least likely to vote. And there have been all these like things in the past, like laws and stuff that have tried to make them be more active. But I think what's happening now is young people are beginning to realize that these things are affecting us. And I think because young people voted so much, that that's why we have such a diverse new Congress. Because if it was left up to like old white males who are predominantly Republicans, it could have gone a different way. But then again, I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that our country is like post-racial or post anything, or because as we've seen, like an unprecedented election of a black president doesn't equate to that. So therefore, an unprecedented number of Congress people diverse doesn't mean that either. But hopefully it begins to show that people are beginning to see beyond race and religion to figure out that we have many more like commonalities than differences. I know that Connor was saying that it seems like it's been more about identity politics, but if you look at it from a different type of way, you could say that people are more willing to work with people who don't look like them or don't follow the same faith as them than in the past. Because in the past, it could have been, oh, you're Catholic. Oh, I'm this. I'm not going to vote for you. I'm only going to vote for this. Or, you know, certain things like that. Or you're gay. I'm straight. I definitely think that it's showing that we have more in common than different.
So would you say that there is, to look at on the other side of that, that there is a positive aspect to, I guess, identity politics, if you want to call it that, that when you have a representation that reflects, you know, a greater broad majority of the American populace, that you'll get different perspectives on different issues. And so the kind of legislation that you would see being, you know, introduced and passed are ones that reflect the majority of Americans, not just a sect of America. Would you say that that is a positive aspect to seeing this surge of demographic shift within Congress and whatnot?
Yes and no, because it's not as if, say where I come from, pretty low income area. Now, let's say that the town I come from, even though it's within a larger congressional district, let's say it just was its own congressional district. Now, when we often talk about this, when legislation for different, you know, for different grievances and needs will be addressed by different identities, I question that a little bit, because that kind of says, okay, so for example, say if it's something to address inner city violence or something, that's almost to say as if it cannot be raised by anyone unless they're of X trait, Y trait.
But don't you think someone from that background has a much better understanding of that issue?
That background isn't necessarily only tied to skin color, religion.
No, I'm not saying skin color, but when I say identity, I'm not talking about just, you know, skin color. I'm talking about all different forms of, you know, identities or how people may identify themselves or their background. Don't you think that it's important that we do have people from this diverse identities and representation so that they can bring a much better understanding of what people are actually going through within different parts of the country?
Absolutely. But I kind of hold that the main thing that kind of changes that, obviously with religion being a big outlier in what I'm about to say, it would be by wealth more than most other traits. And still, the millionaires in Congress outweigh everyone else.
Yes.
You can't, when we talk about wealth there, which I'd say is the biggest determinant of the problems each person faces in America, and so within the socioeconomic class, that's still very skewed. So if we're talking about a more representative Congress, and we look at that which actually matters, it's questionable.
So are you saying that class or socioeconomic status matters more than
it outweighs it outweighs the other, it outweighs most others, I'd say.
Oh, okay. But sorry, but to interrupt, but you can't certain things you can't separate. A lot of the times they're interconnected, they're intersected. Oh, yeah. So as we know, black people are more likely to be in the lower spectrum of the socioeconomic status, not to say that there aren't low income poor whites. We know that there are in Appalachia and Midwest. We know that. But certain, like, historically, statistically, there are more people of color that are in certain situations. And so like, you can't say that socioeconomic status is more important when it's connected to your race many of the times. A lot of the times when you're Black, you're not going to rise in your status, in your socioeconomic status, because you're Black. So you can't just say that, like, oh, this should be viewed higher, and then say that, like, race is not as big of a factor, especially, like, maybe it's hard for you to understand, but just like being with this skin color, it's very, like, it's very important to understand that.
Absolutely. Institutionalized racism is a definite thing that we have to go and fix in this country. It's a big problem. And I completely agree. But however, on a lot of issues, I'd say that, and I'm not trying to say race matters for nothing. I did not say that. I would not say that. But I am trying to say that the biggest representation that I think that we have to overcome, and that is not being addressed and ought to be more, is socioeconomic class. And in that regard, we are far from representative. Now, we can put up a good picture of the Congress, and we can say, wow, there's more colors, there's more headwear, there's everything else. But when we look at actually the bank accounts and the wealth of the people, it's still far from representative. And I think that shows and I think that points to a kind of deeper problem about the structural process of how we do our elections.
Do you think that it's more of the older Congress that's the millionaire sect that you're talking about, or do you think there's also, like, a large proportion of the new Congress that is in this wealthier?
I mean, that's a good question. I'm not going to say whether I think on that, because those are obviously be found in data, and I'll be honest, I don't have that data in front of me. But I mean, you do have those, such as, say, newcomers like Ocasio-Cortez, who, as it was posted about before, that was having trouble finding a home that she could afford to be living while she's here in Congress. But I think that in itself right there shows that there is something kind of worrying about this, because there are so many barriers for people from middle to low income backgrounds to enter in, to represent themselves, to actually go forward with this. And I think that's something that has to be addressed, because so often how our politics is set up is to favor those who, say, have a rich father, mother or father, who can then pay for all their opportunities to advance in politics, because it's oftentimes a career that takes a lot of money to get into. Or those who can go and finance their own elections or so forth. Because money usually equates to power. Right. And I think that's either some societal or structural that we need to fix. But that, in that regards of representation, there's a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm. I think before I move on to the next question, I think this just shows as to why we do need more representation within Congress. Because, you know, when you do all these different identities, they do have a big impact on your perspective on certain issues. You know, when you're talking about race and class, you know, to some people, you know, class is a much bigger issue. And we all agree that class is a big issue in this country. Mm-hmm. But to others, you cannot separate race and class together. So that's why we do need these, you know, diverse perspectives and, you know, different identities in Congress to be able to give people a much broader understanding on these different issues that have to do with race and class and whatnot. And so on to the next question. What role do you see that the new Congress will be playing in regards to its relationship with the White House? And, you know, that's also respective to the roles that different parties would take on. And just to preface this with, we saw an end to the government shutdown over the debate regarding border wall funding, where Trump reached an agreement with both parties to open up the government by passing a continuing resolution without border wall funding, which kept the government, well, hopefully keeps the government open for 3 weeks. And so just seeing, things such as these, where, you know, Trump was not able to get what he wanted right away, where because of this new Congress, which with the House, is the majority of them are Democrats. Do you think that, what sort of relationship do you think Trump will have to have with the new Congress and vice versa in regards to the different parties? I mean, what sort of relationship do you think the new Congress is going to have with Trump?
Well, I'd like to first say that, first off, we're looking at what role it's going to play. Yes. Congress and role, Now, that's always a fun thing to put in two sentences together, because one of the things that I'd say we have to address here is the fact that the executive branch of government is bloated and overall way too big.
Yes.
Congress has oversight. Well, Congress has so little oversight and power compared to what our country actually should be. So that's one of the first things I want to address, especially considering our prior debate about representation. Quite frankly, Congress can be as representative as it wants, but as it increasingly becomes a body that has less and less power, it matters for less and less, and that is very worrying, because that's a concentration of power that shouldn't be there within how the system is designed. So that's the first thing. But as the parties and Trump, now, obviously, Democrats, it's... I actually really don't know how to...
Let's speak on the Republican side. What are you thinking of?
Oh, on the Republican side, I mean, they've certainly... I'm kind of disappointed.
Because they do run the Senate.
Oh, yeah, but I'm pretty disappointed, actually, where they've gone since 2016. 2016, at the beginning, you had a lot of Republicans who were still willing to speak out about Trump in the Senate and in the House, and those voices have now become very, very, very rare.
And what do you think that is?
I think, honestly, it comes down to elections. Mm-hmm. For example, is it Ron Johnson? I don't know. I might be messing up the name. But one of the senators, for example, spoke very vehemently about Trump, when he first got into office, but has since shut up because, oh, hey, look at that. He's up for election 2020. Mm-hmm. Who knew? And same thing with, say, like Rand Paul, for example. Again, someone that definitely criticized Trump a lot and... now he has gone and become much more of a Trump toter, which is terrible to see because I love Rand Paul. Has since shut up because that's unfortunately what the Republican voters are going for. So unfortunately, it does seem like they're going to consolidate a lot more towards rallying around Trump's flag. And that is, it's worrying to see because Republican Party used to be a very diverse party with a lot of different views. And managing it could sometimes be hard, but unfortunately, Trump, at least for now, seems to have gotten them a lot more under control.
Well, hopefully that changes. they start having their own independence in terms of how they govern and whatnot. So what do you think on the Democratic side? Obviously, they run the House. Not much power in the Senate, but they run the purse of the government, as one could say. And so what's going to be the role between, the Democrats in the House and the White House?
So to kind of talk... to go off of what Connor was saying about less power, about the House having less power, increasingly less power. I would say that this, what happened between like the House, Nancy Pelosi and Trump kind of gives a pushback on that. I agree with it to a certain extent, but what we saw definitely shows a different side. I like that Nancy Pelosi did not back down. Maybe it's because I'm just not in the position. I didn't feel the strains of the government shutdown personally, so I probably have a different perspective. But I think that it was about time that the Democrats, put their foot down. We saw it when the Republicans decided not to nominate a judge that Obama nominated. So the Republicans have been doing it for some time, and so the Democrats have taken their time. But it can't be the solution every time. Mm. We can't have 3 week or however long. Yeah, 3 week, 4 week shutdowns every time Trump decides to throw a hissy fit. And then Nancy Pelosi's like, I'm not backing down. No one can compromise. That's just going to lead to more destruction and more people not being able to receive pay. And I would say that we need compromise, but it's like Trump just doesn't seem like that person to compromise. He shut down the government to get something that he ended up opening the government back up without even getting.
Right.
I don't understand the point in that. And now he's threatening to have a national emergency again if he doesn't get his border wall funding. So I definitely think there's going to be more situations like this. With the new Congress, since they're going to be butting heads a lot because of the unwillingness of Trump to make a deal.
And just to that, do you think that Congress, or at least the Dems, the Democrats, since they run the House, should they have to compromise with Trump on things that just physically they don't make a lot of sense to do? Do you think that they should have to compromise? Or should they compromise on things that make great sense fiscally for the country, and it's actually going to produce, you know, great outcomes for the general public.
Well, first off, when you say it doesn't make sense, I mean, that depends who you ask. So that is, can that first has to be cleared up. And there's going to have to be some compromise. Now, Trump isn't necessarily, I'm no fan of him, quite frankly. And he oftentimes goes a bit off the wire, and he's a bit of a demagogue. But the fact is, there's a significant segment of the population behind him. And that will necessitate compromise. It's truly going to be a representative body. You do have to represent the, what is his approval rating at right now? 30-something. Still, that's over a third of the population. That is behind him. So to be a representative body, you do have to compromise a little bit. You can't just discard their grievances as illegitimate because, yes, well, they might not always be, in our minds, very well-founded. The fact is, as a nation, they are part of our conscientiousness. And one thing I want to add on the government shutdown.
Yes.
So I have the U.S. debt clock here in front of me. And I'd like to go and first off say that the government was shut down for 35 days. And notice that the sky did not come crashing down. That for the most part, life for usual Americans went on just fine. Now, granted, that's not to say that there weren't some terrible things that came out of it. You know, people, first off, to every government worker that had to go without a paycheck, especially with Christmas coming, that is terrible to have to do. And to say the national parks, I remember I was reading something about somewhere in California, I forget, really nice trees there, but that's the best I can remember. But the damage that was caused during that time is it will take hundreds of years to repair. But the fact is, though, it shows that there's a lot of glut in the government that we don't actually need. And as I have the U.S. debt clock in front of me right now, as we are at 21,974 billion, and I can go on, but basically approaching $22 trillion. That is, it kind of shows that there's some room to cut, which we might want to do, because if we want to break that number down a little bit, that is $66,904 of debt per citizen. If we wanted to break it down per taxpayer, because fun fact about the 2012 election, actually, you know, remember Romney with his 47% statistic? Fun thing, he actually was wrong. It's 49% of people that don't actually pay into the system. You can check me on Snopes on that. It's actually a real fact check there. The fact is, debt per taxpayer, those who put in more to the system than get out, is $179,000 per taxpayer. That's insane. So right now, what I think that government shutdown definitely shows is that we should really get cutting. And for the 800,000 federal workers who were laid off, my heart goes out to them. That is a terrible situation to be in. But it also does show that as the unemployment rate was, I remember for November, 3.7%, the private sector can take those workers. That the federal government, the public sector, isn't the only place, because I don't see why taxpayer money should be going to jobs then. That obviously, if the country's able to survive at 35 days without, granted, there were some that should have been filled, but with that much glut there, we don't need it. We ought to be cutting a lot before we run our country into a fiscal nightmare.
Well, on the part of cutting, I think obviously we all have different perspectives on that. But, you know, in terms of cutting down the debt, doesn't it, you know, on your part, doesn't it also call for maybe we need to raise taxes on some people so that the government can get more revenues to pay off the debt? And is it always about cutting? Isn't it also about, you know, making sure that we can still provide certain critical services for people that need them, but while also getting more revenue into the government for us to be able to pay off those debts? Wouldn't, you know, what do you say about that in terms of the Democratic side? You know?
I mean, I definitely agree. Like, lower and middle class people should not be expected to pay more or the same amount as people who make millions. And they're the ones that benefit from tax cuts and all this stuff. Because, I mean, that's just a different, like, philosophy type things. Republicans believe that tax cuts are gonna allow companies to increase the amount of jobs, therefore this whole cycle. But I think that we're seeing that that's not really working. Yes, the unemployment rate is low, but people's everyday lives, the quality of life that they're having based on the amount of money that they're receiving, is just not, it shouldn't be the way that it is now.
Mm. And so, you know, we could obviously go into this whole topic about you know, the debt and whatnot. But just on that topic, because we do have to worry about what kind, how much money the government's going to be spending, you know, what kind of legislations or bills do you guys think that there's going to be some compromise with this new Congress in the White House, just so that we can finish off the episode with that topic, if you guys have any in mind?
They're going to, like, compromise?
Yes, you know, in terms of infrastructure, do you think that there is some room for compromise within these different kind of bills?
I'd say it's H.R. 1, the one that brings up corporate donations. Mm-hmm. Republicans might not be seeming to compromise on that, I think it might gain some traction.
Okay.
I think there is something to be said about that as being promising. Okay. I don't know, it's a feeling, but I know that many voters on the right and in the center, it does worry them a lot about the dark money flooding into politics. So I think that, quite frankly, that representatives might be swayed a bit by their constituents to at least hand it over to the states. And where the states are, it's a lot less... I mean, well, varying degrees. I mean, the entire Citizens United case rose out of state politics. But if that's a whole constitutional amendment that we're looking at, the first bill that's introduced into the House. And I think there might be a little bit of power behind that.
And so you talk about campaign finance reform. And on the Democratic side, you know, what do you think? Do you think there's going to be any bills that, you know, Democrats will definitely be for compromise with this White House?
I think we don't have to worry about the compromising on the House side or on the Congress side. I'm just really worried about Trump. The only reason that, because Congress compromised with Trump on, like, they were willing to give him the money. It's just he was just being very hard-headed and wanted this wall because this is what he promised his voters, and he didn't want to look like he couldn't make deals and all this stuff. And it's just, I'm worried about if they'll be able to compromise with Trump, because at the end of the day, Trump is the one that gets to veto it. And honestly, the Senate Republicans are not likely to pass
the veto.
Right. Mm-hmm. They're not likely to pass it without Trump's like approval. But I do think certain things that there's going to be more, media around it, and that they're going to be less... more strict about it, I guess, is like healthcare, immigration, the things that are in the media right now. That's a worry to a lot of people, because obviously they care about like public perception and stuff. Like,
yes,
I wonder what like gun laws are going to be passed and all that stuff. It might not be as, I don't want to say radical, but the gun laws that are passed now would probably be more, with more compromise than if it was during the Parkland shooting. If you get my...
And on that, can you guys say closing words or anything for the listeners?
Yeah, so closing... Well, first off, actually, can I bring it back to one thing earlier?
Yes, yeah.
About the tax thing, because I didn't get to talk on that. And my thought is, now, first off, I was trying to look up something about the U.S. billionaires. I could not find that, but I did find global billionaires. Mm. And this is from Forbes in 2000... This is from 2013, granted, so it's a little out of date. But I remember this article goes and points out that the 1,426 billionaires around the globe at this time, their total sum of wealth came out to $5.4 trillion. Big sum. 2018 federal fiscal budget was $4.094 trillion. So you can go and tax more. But it's not taxation alone. For example, you could go and tax every global billionaire. Mind you, this isn't American billionaires, which is going to be a lower number by just logic there. But you can tax all the billionaires and the richest of the rich in this country. You can tax them more, try to deal with that problem, and you're only going to fund the federal government for a limited time before that comes out. You can't necessarily steal from Peter to give to Paul as a solution. The fact is...
Is that stealing, though, taxes?
that will be a discussion for another podcast. Oh,
we all have a responsibility to our society. Whether you think it's fair or not.
Responsibility is carried through with a man by the gun somewhere along the line. It's a wonder what responsibility that might be. But my thing, though, is that... where was I going from there? Yeah, you have to have some cuts in the process. I think that there might be some to save taxes. I think the tax cut, while we're in a time of economic prosperity, isn't a good economic plan. That should be more when we're in a recession to go and raise up the economy.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't think that was right. But and so But the government has to be cut down a lot to bring it in, to reel it in within reasonable means. Now, for my closing words here, I think this has been a great first podcast. I really look forward to doing this again. Mm. Love both you guys. I mean, great friends, and I'll look forward to doing this again.
All right, and Monique?
Basically the same thing. This is very fun. I feel like I haven't really gotten an opportunity to actually, like, debate with you guys, or, like, with Connor. And so
this is the first episode.
So. Yeah, so it was really good to like, see each other's ideas, and that we actually do have some things in that we agree with each other, but obviously some differences, and that's what this podcast is all about.
Well, hopefully the listeners enjoyed it. We'll definitely keep on improving. You know, this is our first take, and so, you know, next episode, you know, we will try to, you know, just improve on our skills and whatnot. And thank you all for listening to The Voice of Discourse on The Voice Podcast. And make sure to follow The Voice on social media. You can listen to other Voice podcasts on Apple Podcasts as well. Well, see you next time.